So Mark already kind of introduced us, but I'll do it just a little bit as well. So Tom grew up in Madison since he was 2 years old. He's a UW alumni and is currently also a student again getting another degree. So he works for Ballotpedia, which is a nonprofit that publishes nonpartisan political information, no plug intended. But he does work completely remote from home, which if you read our talk, you're probably wondering how the heck did we get away for 10 weeks? And that is part of the reason why we were able to get away, is because he just needs to work with internet. I'm a Madison transplant from Stevens Point, but also a, but also a UW alum for my degree that Mark mentioned. So we've been married for about 4.5 years, and at Cathedral Parish, we're involved in a variety of things. You may have seen me there. We do a lot of website maintenance, posting the audio, for example, which is why we always know how long Monsignor Holmes' homilies are. And we do some hospitality and marriage prep at the parish as well. But getting back to the talk, both of us have always had just a sense of adventure about life. I remember just always having the sense that life is an adventure. I didn't want life to be boring. I wanted the next big thing. Although it's not always in the most traditional sense of adventure. I've never been skydiving and never will. But then came our dreams for doing kind of a long adventure abroad someday. And this really started about a year before we left. We were kind of wondering, well, we have time. And we have, like, we can get the money, we just won't pay off the house as fast or something like that. Like, we're young, we can do this. And we really started to dream about it. And so we had some inspirations for the trip. One of our main inspirations is actually a Netflix series called Departures. I don't know if you guys have seen that. It's three Canadian guys that travel together, and they do, like, making movies for a living, so their photography is just incredible. Am I louder now?
Yeah.
Okay. And they went all over the world, so they would spend a month in every location, and they did this for 3 years. Like, they went to North Korea, I don't even know, some of the other places, just, like, Sudan, yeah, and just in really remote areas, meeting people you would never meet as a normal tourist. We thought that was really cool, but also way too scary. And, like, we didn't want to do that at first. And then we read this book called Vagabonding. And the definition of vagabonding is having no settled home, which really struck me as a Christian. Because as a Christian, we really don't have a settled home in a physical sense. Like, we're passing through this world. I love Rick Steves. I watch a lot of PBS. He's all over YouTube. That was a huge help when we were planning the trip, actually. It helped us narrow down some things. And then just our kind of sense of adventure about life and not wanting to settle for the norm. So we had a few rules that you can see up there. The first rule, by far the most important, was no complaining. If we got uncomfortable, we just made it into a joke, okay? And there were definitely a lot of uncomfortable moments on the trip. We also didn't want to take too many photos. We didn't want to be those tourists with selfie sticks. We took photos to embrace and remember the trip. We took more at the beginning, less at the end. We started to learn. But we really just wanted to be in that moment. We wanted to try new things, be it food, places, experiences. We didn't want to hold back. We wanted to push ourselves. And we really just wanted to soak it all in. When we felt called to, we were just going to do whatever we wanted and just be in a moment. We weren't going to just try to check something off. If we didn't see everything on our list, no big deal. We were going to enjoy what we actually saw. And so, where did we go? Do you mind? So we did backpacking in a very millennial urban sense. We had backpacks, but we also used every form of transportation possible. And so we flew into Paris, and we ended up kind of doing a loop through Northern and Central Europe, going up to Stockholm, taking a ferry across the Baltic to St. Petersburg. When we got on that ferry, we were just really hoping we would still be alive after St. Petersburg, which we were, and our mothers are very thankful. And then we went down to Lithuania for a week and a half, went to Berlin, spent a week in the mountains in Switzerland, rented a car in France for 3 weeks, which was a blast. France is a really big country. You wouldn't quite realize that. And then we went to Belgium for a week and a half, mainly just to eat and drink. We also had visitors along the way. So we started out with a friend of mine from graduate school coming down from the UK to Paris to visit us for a long weekend. Tom's parents flew over and stayed about a week with us in Lithuania. And then my brother flew over and road tripped with us for 2 weeks. If you want to get to know your brother-in-law, road tripping in France for 2 weeks is a great way to do it. And so we had a lot of fun doing that. And so what we want to talk about today is we wanted just to focus on a few main topics. We didn't just want to tell you what we did, where we went. That could be, well, maybe fun for some people, boring for others. And so we really want to focus on some main things that we learned. And so really learning from family history. And then we really just really got struck with the sense of wonder. And so I'll delve a little bit into that. And then just like this, what is really carried with us since this trip is just a really deep sense of gratitude in our daily life. And I think it took that trip and getting us out of our comfort zone to really recognize that in our life. And then for anyone who might be as crazy as we are, we also wanted to give some practical tips. If you want to go away for more than 2 weeks, how do you do that? And so we'll have some tips for you that we definitely learned along the way.
Okay, I see some empty beer glasses, so please feel free to get up and get something else. I wouldn't want to deprive you. Okay, so one reason to travel is to learn and experience history. By studying history, we gain an understanding of the world and insight into the lives and experiences of our forebears, our families, and great leaders and saints of the past. There's obviously a lot of history to learn in Europe, and in our travels, we were most impressed by the history of World War II that we saw in many places, including St. Petersburg, Russia, in Paris, Normandy, in Berlin, and also in Lithuania. The
Tom,
clash.
Yes. You and Tracy are not the same height.
Thank you. Is that better?
Yeah.
Sort of like spinning. How's that?
No, yeah, hold it.
I think the end like wiggles. Okay. All right. Well, I'll lean in. So the clash of ideologies that sort of was manifest in World War II, things like socialism and communism, democracy and capitalism, are still kind of relevant today. And so, as people continue to grapple with the deeper human issues that these ideologies sort of underlie, things like injustice, poverty, equality, and human rights. So much could be said about World War II history in Europe, and you may already know a lot of it. I'm going to focus on a little known corner of... What are you doing to me, Mark? I'm going to focus on a little known corner of Europe called Lithuania. It's close to my heart because I'm 50% Lithuanian. My mom is full-blooded, and I grew up speaking Lithuanian at home and hearing stories about my great aunts, great uncles, great grandparents who experienced the war and lived through a lot of difficult experiences. In the photos you see up here, on the left is kind of some context of where Lithuania is. So it's in Eastern Europe. It's one of the Baltic states along with Latvia and Estonia. It's very close to Poland, a neighbor, in fact, and then also close to Russia. And then on the right we have just a zoom in of Lithuania. Lithuania is about half the size of Wisconsin, for context. And down on the right, you see a tiny little town called Vilnius. That's the capital city of Lithuania. We spent most of our time, of our 10 days there, we were there most of the time. But we also took a car and drove to Kaunas, which is another big city in Lithuania. And then I also want to point out, up way in the north, you probably can't read it, but there's a tiny little town called Šiauliai, which I'll get back to in a little bit. Okay. So during World War II, let's try this again, Lithuania was basically just a small pawn to be captured and traded by the superpowers. When the Soviets invaded Poland to start World War II, they took control of Lithuania. Then briefly, there was a Nazi-Soviet pact where they handed over control to the Germans. It sort of made sense at the time because Germany and Lithuania were trading partners, and also they had a common enemy in Poland historically. But then as Hitler basically decided that he wants to invade the Soviet Union, the Nazis pushed back into Lithuania, and then as his regime started to fall, Lithuania finally disappeared behind the Iron Curtain for the next half century. Lithuanians didn't like the Nazis, obviously. They didn't like being occupied, but they actually were terrified of the Soviets, who had a reputation for horrific acts of violence and basically torture that I'm not going to talk about here. But when it became clear that the Nazis were leaving Germany and losing the war and that Soviet control was inevitable, many Lithuanian families, including my own, decided to leave everything they had and flee. And often over months, maybe with less than just a backpack, they made their way to other parts of Europe and eventually often to the United States. My family wound up in New York City, where they started to build a new life. Some, however, decided to risk staying in Lithuania. My mom's mom had a brother, so that's my great uncle, who had a pretty good job at a sugar factory, and he kind of thought to himself, well, when the Soviets come, they'll need sugar too, right? So he stayed behind. Of course, the Soviets came, they declared him a capitalist, they confiscated everything he had, and they sent him to Siberia. And after many years in the labor camp, his family was able to get him back to the U.S. in the 1960s, but when he arrived, he was a broken man. Basically, he had this kind of weird childlike obsession with books and ice cream. And we don't really know much about what happened to him during those years, but Stalin's slave camps, of course, were notoriously brutal. A similar fate befell my mom's dad's parents, so my great-grandparents, who decided to stay in Lithuania because they were getting a little bit older, maybe in their 60s, and they just thought they were too old to move. So they stayed behind, but when the Soviets came, they were exiled to Siberia, and the Soviets repossessed their small farm and one cow that they had that made them capitalists. And then after many years of exile in Siberia, their family was able to bring them to the United States as well, where they lived out their remaining days in Long Island, New York. These kinds of stories are pretty common. I think they happen to a lot of Lithuanians and people in other parts of Europe. How can such cruelty and malice exist among men? But also, how can such resilience and bravery? These are the kinds of questions that history demands that we ask, not only of the past, but also of ourselves. And it's one thing to kind of talk about them abstractly, but quite another to see their effects that last to this day. Who were these kind of people, like my family, that they deserved to live through experiences like that? And kind of on the flip side of that, who are we that we are spared of that? Here's just a couple of pictures of Vilnius, the main capital city that we stayed in. Up on a hill in that city, there's this memorial of three crosses that commemorates several martyrs who died there, and then that's me looking over the old town. Lithuanians are a proud and stubborn people, so that's where I get it from. They have a long Catholic history, and briefly I mentioned Šiauliai, that town in the north of Lithuania. Oh, by the way, they make really good beer, too. Seriously. So in rural northern Lithuania, there's a hill. It's called Kryžių Kalnas, which means the Hill of Crosses. And it's been a pilgrimage site for Lithuanian Catholics for hundreds of years. I think there's some pictures up here of that. So they basically erected hundreds of thousands of crosses and shrines over time on this hill. When the Soviets took control of Lithuania, of course, they wanted to stamp out religion, the opiate of the people. And so they repeatedly bulldozed this historic Hill of Crosses. In a sign of defiance, though, every time they did that, the Lithuanians would rebuild it bigger. So today, the Hill of Crosses is encrusted with hundreds of thousands of wooden crosses, some large, some small. Crosses hang upon crosses, and there's just a few narrow paths that wind through this maze of Catholic devotional symbolism. We were able to visit this eerie site to pray at a kneeler where Pope John Paul II prayed in 1993. And then we also kind of got to just people watch and see some of the many pilgrims who came there from all walks of life, ranging from a group of Lithuanian seminarians all the way to like a Polish biker gang. We even were able to leave a cross of our own in the same location. This is pictured here where my grandmother left one about 20 or 25 years ago. Like many European nations, Lithuania has now largely forgotten its Christian roots and identity, but places like the Hill of Cross stand as a sign of hope, of faith, and of history, especially of the history of my and so many Lithuanian families that were affected by the ravages of Soviet occupation. In our travels through Eastern Europe, so Russia, Lithuania, and Berlin, which I'll talk about more in a little bit, we often felt kind of the gravity and sadness of some of these places, of the recent dark history. But occasionally, and I would say more so as we traveled west, we also felt a glimmer of hope, of joy, and of beauty. And now I'm going to hand it over to Tracy to talk more about that. I don't know what to do.
Thank you. This is like a daily occurrence. We only have one car. So, so the second thing that we really learned about when we were in Europe is how having a sense of wonder really keeps us on the narrow way of faith and growing closer to God. So I just Googled what is wonder as it's defined, and it says a feeling of surprise mingled with admiration caused by something beautiful, unexpected, unfamiliar, or inexplicable. All four things happen all the time in Europe, especially unfamiliar. And so it was a very common occurrence for us to be wondering both like in an awe-filled way and also in a like, we're driving, and what does that sign mean, way. It was very hot, and they kept telling us to stay hydrated on the highway. It was very nice of them. But I didn't know what hydration was in French. But there are two places that really stick out to me when reflecting on wonder in our trip. So the first was anywhere we were in Switzerland. So when we were planning our trip, we were each allowed three must-dos. That, like, we each got three, and we were doing those six things. And this was one of my three must-dos when we were planning our trip. Primarily, it was because nature has played a really important part of our relationship and faith life. And especially nature has always really reminded me of God's presence and being in awe of something bigger than myself. Since I was even a little girl downhill skiing or visiting the Grand Tetons with my family, I still have a very distinct memory of that, and I was like 7 years old. When Tom and I were dating, our deepest conversations were always during a hike or a long walk in the Arboretum, which is when we kind of accidentally got engaged. story for another day. But being in nature really allowed us to be vulnerable with God and with each other, and it still does to this day. For us, our shared appreciation of nature and the awe we feel is the effect of wonder that we feel in our hearts, this admiration at something beautiful. My friend who visited us in Paris, my friend from graduate school, is actually from Switzerland, which was very convenient because she told us where to stay. And so we stayed in a village called Wengen. It's in the Jungfrau region of Switzerland, basically smack dab in the middle. It has several prominent mountain peaks and is known for the beauty of the mountains. It's also famous for the Jungfrau Peak, which has the highest railway station in the world. And everyone went up there to get a selfie except us. We were not going anywhere near those tourists. But Wengen is a small village which survives on tourism. No cars are allowed up in the village, but everything is brought up by Cograil, including construction supplies, as they were building a house up there. It was wild. But it really led to a very quiet and tranquil week. Now, we've seen plenty of mountains in the United States. There's something really different about being in Switzerland. I read about it. I'd heard about it from my friend. I was just like, really? Have you seen the Tetons? I don't know. But it really was. It really sounds cliche, but like it just left us breathless every time we went outside. What seems almost terrifying, huge waterfalls, sheer cliff faces, lots of avalanches in the spring melt. It's also what elevated our hearts closer to God. There are just so many moments while hiking that we just had to literally pause. We weren't tired, but we just had to soak it all in. Every turn just left us breathless. So these photos that are here, that one is the balcony of our hotel, which is crazy. And Tom trying to work. I don't know how he did it. the other one is of me with something called Trimmelback Falls, which actually contains the melt of three of the biggest mountain peaks. It's a series of 10 waterfalls, mostly within caves, but there's a flow rate of 20,000 liters per second. It was deafening, the sound of it, and like the stone was just, it was polished. It was so cool. And there weren't very many tourists, which was perfect. When you're traveling, you realize you go to where the tourists are not, so you can actually enjoy the moment. It was such a good reminder that as our hearts pounded by what was in front of us, that this beauty that we were experiencing is not what God considers his most beautiful work, but rather we are. that the magnitude and glory of the mountains and the cliff faces were nothing compared to the beauty that God wants to work in our own hearts. And as we saw both cows and sheep grazing, like you're literally cutting through cow pasture, the cows were mostly friendly, it made me think of the parable of the lost sheep, but in a kind of a different way. I was just thinking of like how anyone would want to leave this beauty behind to seek out something less beautiful. And it just really made me think of God seeking out either a lost soul or a lukewarm soul out of immense love for us. And it's just beyond understanding. One soul on fire with love for God is treasured by him more than anything we saw in our travels. And now since returning home from time to time, I still wonder at God's existence, feeling curiosity, admiration, along with a whole lot of amazement. There's just so many times at Mass now that I sometimes look up at, I just look up during the consecration, I just say, is that really Jesus in the Eucharist? And because I truly believe he's there, how should that change my life? How does that change the way I live my life? And when I see the falling snow now and admire the beauty of a snowflake, I'm a chemist, sorry, and the silence the snow creates when it's falling, I just can sense God's presence in the whisper in the breeze. It's moments like our hikes and walks in nature that help me realize how loved I am, that the creator of this beauty takes even more delight in recreating my own heart more closely to his own. The other place that really inspired wonder were many of the Catholic sites we visited in France. It's like really Catholic, guys. It's crazy. But the one that really struck us was Lourdes. It's the site of a Marian apparition from the 1800s. It's now known to at least my brother and us as Catholic Disneyland. The cleanliness of the main promenade was striking. Like, it's literally the Disney castle, guys. Like, it's crazy. We got there and we were like, is this Disneyland? Yeah. It's been very important in my family because my brother was born on the day of the first appearance of the Virgin Mary. And so, you know, you would look in the Catholic Mass and be like, oh, February 11th, Our Lady of Lourdes. And so just a little background for anyone who might not know about this. Saint Bernadette lived in the 1800s and was the oldest of 9 children from a very poor family. On February 11th, my brother's birthday, 1858, 14-year-old Bernadette, her sister and a friend were sent to gather firewood by a nearby stream when a lady appeared in a grotto just a short walk from their home. Now, Bernadette was the only one to see this beautiful lady, and there's a long story about all of these apparitions, but the lady asked Bernadette to return many times. Many people thought she was crazy and nuts, and eventually asking Bernadette to dig in the ground. I mean, there were bystanders that were like, who is this person who's like possessed, you know, digging in the ground? But a spring began to flow fresh water where she dug. And to this day, that spring continues to flow, and its waters are attributed to many healing properties. Today, Lourdes is not the poor village it once was. It has the second most hotels per square kilometer in France, second only to Paris. And it's one of the most visited Catholic sites in the world. Lourdes, with a population of 15,000 people, hosts 5 to 6 million pilgrims per year. Now a large basilica sits on top of the grotto where Our Lady first appeared to Bernadette so many years ago. And within the grounds of the shrine, there are no shops or people trying to sell you souvenirs. Oh, right outside the grounds, it's packed. But it really led to a peaceful experience once you got through that and you were in Disneyland. If you do go to Lourdes, which you could do in October with Bishop Hine when he goes to France, you want to make sure and be there a full day if you ever get the opportunity to go. In the morning, they have an English Mass up in the Basilica, but you can also visit the grotto before there's a line, and you actually don't have to rush through the grotto, and you can take your time. There's a lot of tourists who just come for the day and pack it during the day. In the late afternoon, they have a Eucharistic procession with those seeking healing leading the way. And at dusk, they have a rosary procession from the grotto to the main basilica in many different languages. It was bizarre, like hearing, like all around you are all the different languages, yet somehow we were like kind of praying together. But all along with this, there's more masses and confessions during the day as well. And then this photo is of that rosary procession. We were ended up being towards the back because we were just watching. We didn't even know if we were going to be a part of it. But what really stirred up wonder in all three of our hearts when we talked about this as we were leaving Lourdes was the people watching. It was just fascinating. Lourdes is off the beaten path. You can't just stumble upon it. You are going there as a pilgrim with an intention. And people's intentions were very evident. Some were there to pray for others. Some were there to pray for themselves. And some were simply taking it all in, which I think the three of us were more in that camp than anything else. It was so interesting to see some with very peaceful, calm looks of openness on their faces, while others looked completely desperate for a miracle, hoping that one touch of the grotto would heal them instantly. As they went through the grotto, they were just, the stones are wet in that grotto, and they would just take the wetness and wipe themselves. They just couldn't stop. Like, people had to push them out. During the Eucharistic procession, so those seeking healing are pushed in little buggies by volunteers. You may have seen that in the recent Catholic Herald, there was a picture of the buggies being pushed in front of Lourdes. And again, some were peaceful, some were desperate, and some were just so obviously hurting emotionally and spiritually. Some found what they were looking for. You could see it. But some did not, and they just had looks of utter disappointment on their face. But all of this stems from the faith of one 14-year-old girl. It just makes me wonder, and I would think it would you too, like about our place in history, right? We're in our 20s and 30s. We haven't even lived a third of our life yet, and who knows, maybe even less with modern science. But it makes me think about, like, what's the purpose of my life? Am I making the most out of the one life I have? And is my life even important? As a young adult, we have idealistic and hopeful thoughts for the future, but the only thing we can control is this moment, the current moment. And although I will never be a Saint Bernadette, the thought of how her life leading so many to Christ stirs a fire in my heart to try to be some sort of presence of Christ in my daily life. And when we invite the Lord to take deeper and deeper roots in our heart, it's only natural that we are spurred unto one virtue that has resounded for us the whole trip and since returning home.
So that's gratitude. Okay. So gratitude is maybe one of the most easily practiced virtues in daily life. It's not hard to make a habit of every day just thinking of something you're grateful for. And gratitude draws us out of ourselves to be a receiver, to see everything in life as a gift and to walk through life with joy because we marvel at the goodness we see around ourselves. True gratitude turns us from being self-centered to being Christ-centered. I talked a bunch about my family history in the Soviets, but in World War II, the Nazis did their own evils, mainly to the Jews. When we were in Berlin, we saw many reminders of old Nazi Germany, including the Reichstag. You can tell I like pronouncing German words. So that's the German Parliament building, famously caught fire in 1933, right before the Nazi Party decided to do a power grab and take control of the government. We also saw the Holocaust Museum, which is built right along a stretch of the old Berlin Wall. We saw a replica of Hitler's bunker, where he spent his last days and hours. And then outside of Berlin, we also visited Sachsenhausen, a concentration camp. All of these places recounted in great detail the rise of the Nazi Party, the experiences and ideas that formed Adolf Hitler, and, of course, the suffering and death inflicted on the Jewish people. How could the Holocaust happen? How could such atrocities go unchecked? Another artifact of the war that we saw in Berlin, you can see on the right here, is the Kaiser Wilhelm Memorial Church. This magnificent structure was built in the 1890s, but was heavily bombed during an air raid in 1943. And what you see remains is the crumbling stone arches and broken spire, just part of the entrance hall. As we were walking around outside, I was really struck by this kind of crumbling war memorial. And then across the street is like a giant, glitzy, trendy mall in Berlin. Kind of a strange, Some of these other photos. So in the middle is everywhere you go in Berlin, they've torn down most of the old Berlin Wall, but there's always this double line of bricks that marks where it used to be. So you can't miss it as you travel around Berlin. On the top left is just the side of an old apartment building, stone siding, but you'll notice little pockmarks in it
and that's bullet holes, bullet pockmarks from machine gun spray. And then the bottom left, throughout Europe, of course, there's cobblestones everywhere you go, but in Berlin and in other parts of Germany, and I think even in other parts of Europe, they've now begun replacing some of those cobblestones with these little brass metal things. They're called stumbling stones, and what they are is outside of the homes of where Jews lived, they'll put the name of the Jew, and then if it's known, the date that they were taken and to which concentration camp they were taken as a memorial of what happened to the Jews. We had a really cool bike tour in Berlin, and our tour guide told us that basically, maybe commendably, Berliners don't try to like forget and hide their past. They leave these kinds of memorials all over the city as reminders and a sobering lesson for the future. Getting back to gratitude, though, throughout our trip, we asked each other every night to name one thing that we were grateful for. And while we were in Berlin, both of us were stirred with a profound gratitude just for the circumstances into which we've been born. In another life, maybe we too could have been hiding from Nazi soldiers or hearing machine gun spray rain against our apartment building or cowering in a family church as bombs fall nearby, risking our lives to escape across the Berlin Wall, fearing for the safety of our family and friends. The peace and the freedom that we all experience today is a true blessing. One other place that, of course, inspired great gratitude for us was Normandy. You may know the history. On June 6, 1944, the Western Allies invaded German-occupied territories of northern France at Normandy. Overnight, there was heavy bombing, air attacks that destroyed infrastructure like roads and rail lines. And then at dawn, 150,000 troops landed by parachute and on these landing crafts called Higgins boats. Tracy mentioned that we drove around France for 3 weeks, and while we were doing that to pass the time in the car, we listened to this really interesting audiobook about D-Day. Normandy was almost our last stop by car, so when we got there, we had pretty much finished that book and had a good idea of the history, what led to the invasion, what happened, who the main players were, and also which beaches we wanted to visit. We first stopped in Arromanches, which is this one of the beaches, and they have this, like, I don't know how to describe it, but it's like a 360-degree theater with movie screens all around you, and they play this really moving, like, original war footage of landing craft ramming up on the beach and soldiers climbing out, and it's pretty moving. And then from the top of the hill there, you can look down into the bay and you see these old, like, sunken breakwaters that the Allies dropped in the sea to try to shield some of the boats from waves, just remnants of that lying in the bay. After Arromanches, we went to the two beaches where the U.S. troops arrived, Utah and Omaha. Today, they're used as normal beaches by the local French, so you can go there and see people sunbathing and swimming. It's kind of strange. But of course, to them, it's just a beach. But for us Americans, we could only imagine the scene on D-Day. And seeing and climbing into one of these Higgins boats, which we got to do, I think that's the next slide. It looks like that. It's basically like a wooden box. And then just imagining, you know, soldiers who are far younger than us climbing out of these boats, hearing gunfire whistle over their heads and wondering if they're going to live through the day. We also experienced what D-Day must have been like for the German troops when we visited a recently excavated German bunker and kind of trench system that was discovered just a few years ago after having been buried in a farmer's field for many years. This location had like these giant concrete platforms on which huge guns would have sat, and these guns could shoot miles in either direction to both of the beaches. We sort of imagined again like the fear of maybe these German soldiers as they could hear heavy bombing all night and then waking up at dawn and seeing hundreds and thousands of ships and soldiers coming on shore, basically fighting them. The Germans in that particular bunker were completely surrounded before they finally surrendered. And then last kind of Normandy stop that we made was at the American cemetery, where over 9,000 soldiers' graves are located. As you walk around that cemetery, you can see all of these rows of perfectly aligned stone graves, many crosses, some Stars of David, and they're all engraved with like the state where the soldier came from, the date that they died, mostly dates surrounding D-Day.
and kind of the extreme precision of that place and meticulous groundskeeping, every blade of grass cut just perfectly, really gives a lot of dignity and honor to those who lost their lives there. Also, all the visitors showed great reverence, which kind of was very moving. How many of the Allied soldiers who fought in World War II knew what they were fighting for? Like, were they just following orders, or did they understand that their sacrifices would be freeing millions of people and saving countless lives? I think one thing that I reflect on from that is also, do I know what I'm fighting for in our lives? Do we know the consequences of our own actions?
So those who know us well would be disappointed if we didn't talk about something that Tom and I are especially grateful for every day, and that would be food. As a chemist, I've always enjoyed cooking and baking. I grew up watching Food Network while all of my friends were watching The Bachelor and who knows what else. And Europe was a whole new salivating adventure all in itself. We had our favorites, one of which was Ellie Go. It's the one of Tom in the center there with his glass of wine. But it's like cheesy mashed potatoes. It's only popular in Paris right now, but I got to get the old-fashioned to start making it. But more than that, we found a very different way to enjoy food. Everything was new and delicious over there. We never went to the same grocery store or restaurant more than a couple of times. But the freshness and easy proximity to a bakery or grocery store really gave us pause. Everything is walkable. We were always buying food as we needed it, rarely buying more than a couple days ahead of time. I mean, we literally had a backpack each. And we really slowed down to enjoy all of it, these new and delicious treats to us. We also wasted far less food than we had before, and that same habit has really followed us home. I'm doing a lot more cooking than before. I'm exploring new recipes. I'm going to the grocery store at least twice a week, but that's like my favorite store, so it's really not a hardship. And although it takes some more time, we're just connecting a lot more in the process and enjoying kind of all these treats that we enjoyed when we were over there. I made like an 8-layer Russian honey cake for Tom's birthday and his brother's birthday, which is just a week and a half before his. In the center, but mine was a lot bigger, and it was awesome. So to summarize these points, we're going to draw on a quote from St. John Vianney. He's the patron saint of priests, and we were able to pray before his relics in France when we were visiting ours. I chose instead of his relics, which I think many people have seen or it's easy to see, but this is what he would have seen while celebrating Mass. It's kind of in the middle of the basilica, but looking at the old church of his parish church. And he has this quote of saying, "If people would do for God what they do for the world, what a great number of Christians would go to heaven." So just as we spent a lot of money, 10 weeks of our life traveling around Europe as tourists in different countries, putting up with a lot of discomfort along the way, are we willing to do the same thing for God? Are we willing to take a step back, allow him to lead us through discomfort and the unknown in our daily life with as much faith and excitement as we did while traveling in Europe? Now for us, continuing to learn from our family history, having a sense of wonder as we travel through our daily life, and practicing gratitude along the way is a reminder to us that we are not made for where we might be today, but we are truly only tourists in this world. And so I wanted to also end with giving some practical tips for anyone who might be crazy like us. And so, just briefly, the first thing you gotta figure out is work. You can't lose benefits while you're gone. So how are you gonna get time off if you wanna go on an extended trip? So I'm a teacher, I took the summer off, which was great. And so I did most of the planning for the trip because I didn't have to work. And then Tom was able to negotiate a lot of time off. His company was very generous, so that was great. And then the second thing you have to do is just dream. Like, where do you want to go? It doesn't have to be Europe, but like, it could be the U.S. Like, where do you want to go? And how long would that make you be abroad for? You might have a timeline because of work, you might not. The next thing is budgeting. Traveling costs money. So what is your weekly budget going to be? Lithuania was half the price of Paris. Okay, so like it's also kind of based on where you're going for what your budget is going to be. And like, don't just save to the penny what you need. Budget more, right? You're going to see things that you want to do. You don't want to feel like, oh my gosh, I got all the way over here and now I can't afford to do this $50 thing. And then a lot of planning. It's a lot and totally worth it. But a lot of lists, a lot of Google Maps. What do you need to book ahead of time? There's a lot of free walking tours, a lot of biking tours that we would do the first day we got somewhere just to get a lay of the land, learn from one of the locals. That was totally worth every penny of that. And a lot of it's tip-based as well. So like you're not even paying ahead of time. You can kind of pay based on how good it was. They were all really good though. But then some things you can't just show up to. So like one of the favorite things that we did on the whole trip was we went to a Nutcracker ballet in Russia. And we bought those tickets like 3 months in advance. And like it sold out, you know, like 6 weeks before it was already sold out. And so you got to book some of it in advance in order to be there. I think we are probably the only Americans there, honestly. Everyone was speaking Russian, so I don't know. Yeah, and once you're there, you just don't want to waste a lot of time figuring out what you're going to do, right? You're there. Like pick from a list, pick from a map. You've already done the research. And then backpacking is really important. Don't check a bag if at all possible. Just bring a backpack. We got these really awesome Osprey backpacks that were carry-on size, and we just made it work. And so my shoes are a lot smaller than Tom's shoes. That makes a big impact. But but you want to pack for the everyday. Synthetic clothing dries very quickly. My lowest point of the whole trip was doing laundry in a hotel waste basket because the sink was too small to do laundry, but we had nothing that was clean. But hey, we're good. Every time I do laundry now, I'm so excited for my wash. I'm like not kidding you. That washing machine's amazing. But we each brought about 6 outfits for 10 weeks. And so you just cycle through and you just make sure everything mixes and matches. And packing cubes. I never knew about them. You should just get packing cubes, no matter what you do. Like, it's just amazing to, like, organize all your stuff in a suitcase. Nothing falls out. Just invest. It's incredible. Yeah. Good? So we're happy to also... Oh, yeah. We blogged while we were over there that Mark mentioned. So if you're curious about catching or seeing our blog, it's a very catchy title, tracyandtom.com. And then Euro 2019, because we went last year. And so this is a picture from France in the Alps. We hiked to a French chalet that was completely off the grid, pit toilets and all. And this was like on a really hot day when we finally saw the chalet. I was so excited. That was probably the lowest day of the trip. But yeah, we finally got there. It was good.